about, we finished our series on David last week, and today we're going to talk about something that sometimes affects us all in a negative way, and so I'm going to try to get us to look at things in a different way. Today's sermon is going to be about perspective and how we look at the situations we go through in our life. A shoe manufacturer decided to open a new factory in the Congo, and he sent two of his scouts down there to scout out the region and see what the people were like and everything. And one of his salesmen reported back, the prospects here are zero. Nobody wears any shoes. And the other salesman reported back, market potential is terrific. Everybody's barefoot. See, they looked at the situation, but they saw it different ways. One saw it with the proper perspective and one didn't. So how do we see things, guys? Our perspective determines everything in our lives. And there are two ways of looking at every situation. Two, with our own eyes and our own human understanding, or with God's perspective and what God has already said. Incorrect perspective cost a whole generation of people to die. Numbers 13:2, New International Version. Send some men to explore the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the Israelites. From each ancestral tribe, send one of its leaders. And what they did is they didn't just pick anybody. They picked if President Trump was to send people to represent each state to a meeting overseas, he wouldn't just pick anybody. He'd pick the 50 governors and send them over there. And that's what they did here. They picked the leaders of the 12 tribes, and they sent them on a fact-finding mission, so to say. So that's the first thing to notice. The other thing is this. It's a done deal. Before they even leave to go scout out the land, God says, explore the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the Israelites. It's a done deal. God already gave it to them. They haven't seen it come to fruition yet, but God said it's going to happen. God is testing his people here. He wants to see how they're going to look at things and what they're going to do with what he's given them. Moses tells them in Numbers 13:18-20, New American Standard. See what the land is like, and whether the people who live in it are strong or weak, whether they are few or many. How is the land in which they live? Is it good or bad? And how are the cities in which they live? Are they like open camps or with fortifications? How is the land? Is it fat or lean? Are there trees in it or not? Make an effort then to get some of the fruit of the land. Now the time was the time of the first ripe grapes. Now God did this on purpose, picking this time of year, harvest time. And all these questions from Moses, all these things he sent them to scout out were really meaningless. Because God already told them, the land is yours. So the men go through the Negev. The Negev was the desert region of Israel. We'll see that when we go over. And they come into the land. And the very first thing they see when they come into the land are grapevines. And the grapevines have grapes on them, big grapes. And the vines, a single cluster is so big that it took two men to carry them on a pole. They would walk like this, put the grapes on a pole, and the other guy would have the other end of the pole on his shoulder back here. So they knew it was a land that was plentiful, just like God said it would be. So they spied out the land for 40 days. And at the end of 40 days, they come back to the wilderness and they meet up with Moses and the rest of the Israelites. The 12 men are ecstatic at what they've seen. Numbers 13:27, New Living Translation. This was their report to Moses. We entered the land you sent us to explore, and it is indeed a bountiful country, a land flowing with milk and honey. Here is the kind of fruit it produces. And they had this big cluster of grapes. Now, this shouldn't have surprised anybody that what kind of land God was sending them to, because back in Exodus 3:17 in the NIV, God told them, and I have promised to bring you out of your misery in Egypt into the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, a land flowing with milk and honey. So here we have two things before they even get started. God already told him he was going to give them the land, and God already told him what the land was like. God also told them that the Canaanites lived in that region. But here is where 10 of the 12 spies begin to lean on their own understanding and their own perspective of things. Instead of believing what God told them, they start looking at what their eyes told them. And this is what gets all of us in trouble. Here's the thing with God's promises, guys. See, they didn't believe God's promises because their eyes told them something different. God's promises usually do not make sense until we've come through whatever we're going through and we can look back and see God moving in our lives. It's an easy thing for all of us to do, to lose perspective. We place our trusts, our feelings, and our plans and everything in our lives on what we can see and what we can hear and what we can feel. That's why it's called faith. We have to trust in what God says. Numbers 13, 18, New American Standard. Nevertheless, bad word, right? All you guys are in Sunday school and Bible study. Nevertheless, the people who live in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large. And moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. There's that same word, nevertheless. That's the same word Jesus uses in Revelation chapters 2 and 3 over and over. What's nevertheless mean? You guys are in my Sunday school or Bible study class. Nevertheless. What's it mean? It means but. You never want to hear that. Especially the churches. We've said this before. It's like Jesus sent letters to all the churches and he said, man, your Sunday school program's great. You guys are really growing. It was a tremendous VBS last week. You guys are out of this world. But you never want to hear that. The land is great, they're telling them. Absolutely perfect. Beautiful land. But the people there are bigger, big and strong, and we're just puny and weak. What can we possibly do against them? See, they didn't have to do anything except show up and watch God do what God said he was going to do. But they've taken their eyes off of God and put their beliefs in what their eyes tell them and their surroundings and their circumstances and what's going on. But Caleb spoke up. Numbers 13:30, English Standard Version. But Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, let us go up at once and occupy it, for we are well able to overcome it. See, he saw the same thing that the other 10 guys saw, but his perspective is different. He has his beliefs and his perspective on God. He silenced the crowd and the naysayers. This is a guy that believed God's promises, and it's going to pay big dividends because only two of these guys are going to get to enter that land. The other 10 men were cowardly. They replied to Caleb and to the rest of Israel like this. Numbers 13:31. But the other men who had explored the land with him disagreed. We can't go up against them. They're stronger than we are. Now listen, they saw the same thing. Then they spread that story throughout the land. They went through all the camp. Like, you guys, there's a million people here, so everybody can't hear. So these 10 are now coming out among you guys saying, there's no way we can go up and take this land. There's no way we can go up and take this land. These guys are bigger than us, stronger than us. The cities are fortified. There's no way we can do this. And see, what happened is you guys, not you guys, okay, but the Israelites, believed those 10 people instead of trusting in God. A farmer was approached by a man one day, and the man came up and he asked him, how much is your prized Jersey cow worth? And the man thought for a second, I know, Ed, it probably wasn't a cow. It was probably, I don't know what it was, but. And the farmer thinks for a minute, and he says, that depends. Are you with the IRS, or are you the guy that killed my cow with your car? See, the value of the cow depended on who's asking the question. And the guy was smart enough to realize that. If you're the IRS guy, well, she was only worth about $50. But if you just killed my prized cow with your car, she was worth about $5,000. Perspective. The Israelites believed the reports of the 10 men. The men that stated, we can't go up and take this land. They're too strong for us. They spoke out against Moses and Aaron and Caleb, and they wished they had died back in the land of Egypt. Now, this is kind of contradiction in terms anyway. If you wish you'd have died back in Egypt, what makes any difference if you die taking the land? But they're saying it would be better for us to just have died back there as slaves in Egypt. You guys should really read the book of Exodus if you've never read it. You read the book of Exodus, it's all about God's chosen people, the nation of Israel, and how it was formed and born. And you read that book and you just shake your head and shake your head and think, these people are out of their minds. So look at how they responded in Numbers 14, verse 3, part A, New Living Translation. Why is the Lord taking us to this country only to have us die in battle? Okay, now look, their perspective has changed here. Now look who's where the fault lies. Who's to blame for all their misery now? God is. Why God let us come out here into the desert just to die, into this wilderness? Well, he didn't. He said, go take the land that I'm giving you because it's a great land filled with milk and honey. That means it's prosperous, okay? It doesn't mean there's literal milk and honey flowing every place. It's a prosperous land. But they're blaming God for bringing them to this point, and they're afraid to go any further, and they need somebody to put the blame on, so they're blaming God. Their perspective has been blinded by the report of the 10 men. But way back at the beginning, Moses already told them, this is a done deal. God is giving us this land. All they had to do was go take possession of the land. They didn't have to do anything. They didn't have to form a military. They didn't have to do anything. Just go take possession of the land. Sometimes, Brian's guilty of this, sometimes we have that same perspective of God. It's easy to look back at these guys in the Bible and say, you people are out of your minds. Listen, we have that same perspective. When times get tough and we're going through tough times, what do? All of us, me too. Why are you doing this to me, God? What have I done? Ever said that? I've said that. It's been a long time, but I've said that. It's easy to lose perspective when things get tough. It's easy to take our mind off of what God has promised when times get tough. Moses and Aaron fell down before God and tore their clothes. That was a sign in these days of great mourning. They literally tore their clothes off, and that was a sign of desperation before God and sadness, deep sadness before God. Joshua has sided with Caleb and said, yep, let's go up and take the land. So we got two guys saying, let's go take it, and 10 guys saying, there's no way we can take it. Joshua says in Numbers 13:9, New American Standard, only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not fear the people of the land, for they will be our prey. Their protection has been removed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them. Joshua recognized that whatever has protected them for the last 1,000 years while they've occupied this land is gone. God has removed it, and God is now on the side of the Israelis, and he's going to bring them into this land. And it doesn't matter how many battles they've won, how many nations they've conquered, how big their military is, none of that matters. Joshua recognizes that God has taken away their protection. And in the case of let's shoot the messenger, the people decided what they're going to do is stone Aaron and Moses and Caleb and Joshua. Now, to see how important this whole thing is, this is how God responded to these people. Now, here's the four, Moses and Aaron and Joshua and Caleb, and they're up here telling the people, let's go take this land, and you guys are back here saying, no way, we can't take it. They're too strong for us. And you guys are all picking up rocks. You got rocks in your hands. You're ready to throw, and then God speaks. Numbers 14, 11 and 12, NIV. The Lord said to Moses, how long will these people treat me with contempt? Listen, they're ready to stone these four guys up here, but who are they really mad at? How long are you going to treat me, God, with contempt? Listen, God's not fooled. We try to rationalize our sin, and we try to hide our sin, and we try to bury our secrets, but listen, God's not fooled. The Bible says that God knows even the thoughts behind the thoughts that control the words that come out of your mouth. How long will they refuse to believe in me in spite of all the signs I have performed among them? Now this is the generation, these are the people that were in Egypt when God sent the 10 plagues and miraculously brought Israel out of the land. These are those people. I will strike them down with a plague and destroy them. But I will make you into a nation greater and stronger than they." Notice a few things. As we said, they're ready to stone him. These guys are really mad at God. They're blaming God for all this. How long will these people treat me, God, with contempt? Also note that, listen, God didn't need any of these people. God said, "Get out of the way, Moses. I'm going to kill them all. And then with just you four, I'm going to turn Israel into a great nation." That's an important lesson to learn. God doesn't need us for anything. We need God. That's the perspective we need to have, guys. Moses pleads for mercy from God for the people of Israel. This is what kind of leader he was. And God forgives them for Moses' sake, not because they deserve it, just like us. Just like when Jesus hung on a cross, none of us deserved that. Okay, he did it because of his mercy. But there's going to be a price to pay. Numbers 14, 21 to 23, New Living Translation. "But as surely as I live, and as surely as the earth is filled with the Lord's glory, not one of these people will ever enter the promised land. They have all seen my glorious presence and the miraculous signs I performed, both in Egypt and in the wilderness. But again and again they have tested me by refusing to listen to my voice. They will never see the land I swore to give their ancestors. None of those who have treated me with contempt will ever see it." Listen, he forgave them, but there's still a price to pay. None of these people are going to enter into the promised land. And out of these four people, only Joshua and Caleb will eventually enter into the land of Israel. Listen, this is why the Israelites wandered around in the wilderness for 40 years. I've heard this saying over and over in my life: "You're wandering around like a lost Jew." Listen, they weren't lost. They were being punished by God. And that's why they had to keep setting up this tabernacle, which was a huge undertaking, and taking it down every time God decided he wanted to move someplace else. They were being punished. This is why they were being punished, right here. Those people, all of them, 20 years old and up, will not see the promised land. They're going to die in the wilderness. God takes this very seriously. Numbers 14, 29, New American Standard. "Your corpses will fall in the wilderness, even all your numbered men, according to your complete number, from 20 years old and upward, who have grumbled against me." See why God's mad? God's mad because all this stuff's going on around them. Their lives are falling apart. They're in the wilderness. They're hungry. They're tired. They're thirsty. And they're grumbling, and they blame God. Why has God led us out here to die in the wilderness? You see what God says here? "You're all going to die who grumbled against me, who blamed me." Perspective determined the fate of all of these people, how they looked at things. Four of them wanted to go take the land. 1,000,010 of them didn't. And 1,000,010 of them died in the wilderness. A freshman in college wanted to please his dad. His dad was an excellent 1,500-meter runner. And so he decided he'd go out for the 1,500-meter race on the track team. And so the first race, the coach puts him up against one of the best milers. 1,500 meters is just about a mile. Puts him up against the best mile runner in the college. And just the two of them have a race. And, of course, the good runner beats him by a mile, as the saying goes. And so the kid, not wanting to disappoint his dad, he sends his dad a letter home, and it says this: "Dear Dad, you will be happy to know that I ran against Bill Williams, the best runner in the school. He came in next to last, but I came in second." Perspective. Sometimes the situation looks bleak. So I know what a lot of you guys are going through in here. Dark clouds surround you during the day, and sleep evades you at night. I know some of you guys are at the end of your rope, worn out, exhausted, tired of being tired, tired of fighting the fight. I know some of you guys have done everything to please other people, and they've walked out of your life. I know some of you try hard every day to be the the best dad, the best mom, the best student, the best Christian, the best person, the best teacher, the best athlete. And sometimes the harder you try, the further behind you fall, and it seems like the worse things get. This happens a lot in the Christian's life. I know some of you guys are tired of the uncertainties and the waiting, not knowing what's coming next. I know a lot of you guys are hurting due to circumstances beyond your control. I know some of you guys suffer in silence, and you come in with smiles on your face, and when people say, how you doing, you say, doing good, how you doing? I know some of you guys think nobody can understand what you're going through, not even God. And I know that some of you may be ready to quit on yourselves and on God. Life takes us in that direction sometimes, guys. I know that in the midst of the worst times in your life, sometimes it seems like you are all alone. In 2 Kings chapter 6, the king of Aram, an enemy of Israel, decided to attack the Israelites. But he had a problem. The prophet Elisha, God kept telling him the plans of the king of Aram. He kept telling the king of Israel the plans of their enemy. And so time after time, when Aram would come to attack Israel, because Elisha had been told by God where they're going to attack, the king of Israel had his troops ready. If they attack on the plains, he had his troops here. If they came in from the hills, he had his troops here. And he frustrated the king of Aram over and over. As you can imagine, that didn't sit well with the king of Aram. 2 Kings 6:10, NIV. So the king of Israel checked on the place indicated by the man of God. Time and again, Elisha warned the king so that he was on his guard in such places. We see here that Elisha warned the king over and over. 2 Kings 6:11, NIV. This enraged the king of Aram. He's not just a little upset. He's fuming mad. He's cussing and swearing. He's out of his mind here. This enraged him. He summoned his officers, and he demanded of them, tell me, which one of you is on the side of the king of Israel? See, he thought he had a mole in the ranks. He thought he had a spy, somebody here who was spying for the king of Israel. That wasn't going on at all. God was telling his prophet Elisha everything that was going on. And that's how the king of Israel found out. But this guy didn't have that information, so he's blaming whoever he can blame. 2 Kings 6:12, New Living Translation. It's not us, my lord the king, one of the officers replied. Elisha, the prophet in Israel, tells the king of Israel even the words you speak in the privacy of your bedroom. No one can figure out how Elisha is getting his information. See, God's telling him, nothing surprises God, nothing we do escapes the attention of God. He's a prophet. He's getting his information straight from God. So the king orders his men to hunt down Elisha and drag him back. He's going to kill him. The servants of the king of Aram find out where Elisha's staying, and by night they draw up to attack the town where Elisha the prophet is staying. Next day, Elisha looks out, and Elisha had a servant, security guy, who traveled with him. And they wake up the next day, and the servant looks out, and he sees all these enemy troops surrounding them. And he's scared out of his mind. 2 Kings 6:15, NIV. When the servant of the man of God got up and went out early the next morning, an army with horses and chariots had surrounded the city. Oh, no, my lord. Sounds like a cheap Hollywood movie, I know. What shall we do? The servant asked. Is this where you're at? Are you surrounded by your enemies, filled with doubt? Scared? Does it look like it's all over? That there's no way you're getting out of this mess. This is it. There's no coming back from this. The enemy has you surrounded, and the results are a foregone conclusion. That's what Elisha's servant thought. Do you say, like the psalmist said in Psalm 121, verse 1, part B, where will my help come from? Where are you, God? I've been crying out to you, and I've been on my knees, and I've been begging you, and I've been asking you, where are you, God? You just don't show up. Oh, sure, you're there in the good times, but when things are going bad, where are you, God? But Elisha replied to his servant the same way God would reply to us. 2 Kings chapter 6, verse 16, New American Standard. So he answered, he being Elisha, "Do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them." Now Elisha is seeing the same thing that his servant's seeing. Here's a whole army of invaders that want to kill those two men. And the servant looks out, and he's terrified. And Elisha looks out and says, "What are you so shook up about?" Perspective. 2 Kings 6:17, English Standard Version. Then Elisha prayed and said, "O Lord, please open his eyes that he may see." So the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. Perspective. "I will never leave you, Jesus." Listen, Ephesians 6:12 tells us we're in a spiritual warfare. Everything we face in our lives is a spiritual warfare. Chris alluded to that earlier. It's spiritual warfare. Elisha knew that. He believed God. He trusted God. Listen, are you ready to quit? Are you overwhelmed by life? Are you overwhelmed by your circumstances? Listen, like Elisha, I pray that God can open your eyes and that you guys will see the army of heavenly beings that surround you and protect you and care for you. And God's holding you in his hand. Even when it feels like he's not, he still has you in his hand. He promised, "I will never desert you, never. I will never leave your side. I will never abandon you to your circumstances. Never, 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 never." Either you believe that or you don't. There's no in between. When we get into these situations, we can't control them. We can't handle them. Things are happening and it's spinning out of control. We want to see things with our eyes and reason things with our minds. And when we do that, we take our heart and our minds and our eyes off of what God has already promised. And what God's already promised is, "I'm going to see you through this." Listen, everybody knows the 23rd Psalm, right? "Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death," listen, has he come out the other side? He's still in the middle of his fight, of his war. This is David. He's being chased by Saul. He's still in the middle of that when he says, "Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, you're still with me." No matter how bleak things are, no matter how bad things look, you're still with me, God, and I believe you, and I trust you. This is where David was. Sometimes the only way for God to show us how great he is to put us in circumstances that we cannot control, that we can't work out on our own. Sometimes that's the only way God can demonstrate to us how great he is. Hebrews 12:1, English Standard Version. "Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us." Nobody knows for sure who wrote Hebrews, but look what the writer said. We are surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses. The next verse after that says, "And let us fix our eyes on Jesus." Sometimes it's lonely up here, guys. Sometimes God's given me a sermon he wants me to preach, and I know it's going to ruffle some feathers, and I know some people aren't going to like it, and I know some people are going to hate me for saying the words. I have a painting in my office at home. Painting is called The Legacy. It's by a man named Ron DeCiani. And it has a pastor, and he's holding up a Bible like this, and he's preaching to his congregation. And then he's surrounded by ghost-like figures. And Jesus has his hand on his shoulder, and his other hand is lifted up to God, and Elijah and Moses and John the Baptist and all these guys are there in goose form because they're spirits now, and they're all praying for the pastor as he preaches. Sometimes when I know I have a tough sermon to preach to you guys, I'll stand and I'll look at that painting, and it will put things in proper perspective for me. That painting, and I'm just telling you guys this to show you that perspective changes everything. That painting reminds me that I'm not called to please people. I'm not called to make friends or have followers. I'm not called to be a people pleaser. I'm not called to entertain you guys. I'm not called to be eloquent. I'm not called to do any of that. I'm called to do one thing: preach God's word and teach you what it says, period. That's what God called me to do. And see, when I look at that painting, it puts things in proper perspective for me. Then I can come up here and say whatever I need to say because it's not my words, it's God's words. And I take this very seriously. But I tell you all that to say that it's all about perspective. See, when I have my eyes on me and how you guys might react to what I say, there's a problem. I don't want to come up here and do it. But then when I put my eyes on God and what God wants me to do. Listen, I tell you that because everyone in this room should have that same perspective. Here's the perspective you should have as a child of God. You ready? God first. That's it. That should be the perspective of every child of God. It's your way first, God. Before my feelings, before my eyes, before what I think, before what I see, you first, God. Thanks, Deb. Some of you guys may have heard this story. A little boy goes into a field with a baseball and a bat. And he takes that ball and he says out loud, "I'm the greatest hitter in the world." And he throws that ball up and that ball comes down and he swings that bat and he misses. Strike one. And he picks that ball up again and he throws it up in the air and he says, "I'm the greatest batter in the world." And that ball falls to the ground, strike two. Then he takes that ball in his hand again. He throws that ball in the air. It starts to fall back to the earth. The bat comes off his shoulder. You hear a mighty swoosh as he swings. And then you hear the thud as the ball hits the ground, strike three. Little boy picks up that ball, puts a bat on his shoulder. He starts walking home, shaking his head. And he has a smile on his face. And he thinks to himself, "Man, even I didn't know I could pitch that well." Perspective. That's how you look at things. Judas is dead. Jesus is risen. He appears to 10 of his disciples. Thomas is not with them. They report that they've seen the risen Christ. John 20:25, NIV. So the other disciple told him, this is the 10 telling Thomas, "We have seen the Lord." But he, Thomas, said to them, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe." Now Jesus has spent the previous 3 years telling all these guys that he's going to die and be raised from the dead on the third day. Nobody believed him, nobody. Not his disciples, not the women who went to the tomb. They didn't go there to see the resurrected Jesus. They went there to anoint his dead body. Nobody believed what he had been telling them for 3 years. This is where we get the phrase "doubting Thomas" from. But he's not the only one. So this is how this plays out. A week later, the disciples, including Thomas, are all standing together in a locked room. And suddenly Jesus is there with them in their midst. John 20, 27 and 28. Then he, Jesus, said to Thomas, "Put your finger here. See my hands? Reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe." Thomas said to him, "My Lord and my God." Thomas had his whole perspective changed in an instant. He went from doubting to believing. John 20:29. Then Jesus told him, "You believe because you have seen me. Blessed are those who believe without seeing." So where does that leave us? It leaves us the same place as it left Thomas. We have to do what Jesus said. Stop doubting and believe. You want to see your circumstances change? Stop doubting and believe. You want to climb up out of that hole? Stop doubting and believe. You want to see brighter tomorrows? You want to enjoy today? Stop doubting and believe. Jesus says, "Blessed are those who believe in me without seeing me." It's all about perspective. How do we look at things? I gave you guys some examples of people who looked on the bad side and people who looked on the bright side. Who do you think were happier? Circumstances weren't any different. The little boy with the ball and bat, his circumstances didn't change. The 10 spies going in to spy out the land, the Canaanites didn't change. The kid running track at school, he still lost that race. It's all about how we look at things, guys. Listen, Jesus loves you. He wants you to live a full and complete life. He doesn't want you down. He doesn't want you beating yourselves up. But we do that. Somebody says something and ruins our day, and you guys know how this goes. You could have 10 people tell you, "Man, you guys look really nice today." And you could have one person say something to you like, "Where'd you get that at?" And we forget all about those 10 and let that one person ruin the rest of our day. Why do we do that? We all do it. Brian does it. We all do it. It's about perspective. Listen, my challenge to you guys is this. For this week, 1 week, let your perspective be on what Jesus promised and not on your circumstances that surround you. For 1 week, see if your lives change a little bit. I love you guys. Jesus loves you guys.
As Brian started reading the scripture, a New Testament version of that came.